German Zeppelin Hindenburg, Queen of the Skies, seen here from a Universal newsreel camera plane as it sped over New York to its tragic end at Lakehurst, New Jersey, now lies at the Naval Air Station a twisted mass of metal. Shortly after these pictures were taken, showing the great skyliner saluting the millions watching it from below on its first trip of the season, the huge craft exploded while docking and blazed to a fiery end, taking the lives of almost half its 99 passengers and crew. Hours late on its trip from Hamburg because of headwinds, the Zeppelin had to ride out a thunderstorm along the Jersey coast before heading for the air station and nosing its way to the mooring mast. The wind is bad and the docking is a ticklish one, but it's all a thrill for the crowd of happy passengers eager to land after their transoceanic trip. Slowly the big ship warps in and the ground crews rush for the mooring lines. In another 10 minutes or so, the great aircraft would have been snugly docked. But as the passengers crowded the windows to watch, a roar and a burst of flame near the big tail fins turned the ship into a flaming inferno.
Oh, the humanity.
Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
Yes, we hope you like us when we're angry. I'm Dean Karyanis.
And I'm Owen Mugen.
And welcome back to the Angry History Show. We are very glad to be back with you. We've been off doing some other projects, but they were all history related, so have no fear. And we're going to really start ramping up production here so that you folks who are kind enough to download and listen to us can get used to a regular schedule of hearing our dulcet tones.
Absolutely. It's been an awesome couple of months. Very, very busy. Dean said doing really cool history related stuff, which we can get into down the road. Super psyched to be back. We have a packed summer schedule for you guys and for us because, you know, seriously, we love this as much as hopefully you guys enjoy listening to it. Today, Dean, what are we on, pal?
We are on Oh, the Humanity, the story of the Hindenburg. Continuing series here about kind of fire happening. So,
yes, fire and terrifying death, you know, in the tri-state area, generally, of New York.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. Although the Hindenburg, actually, when you look at it a certain way, it's more of a success story in the sense that more people survived than died in it. But it's just, you know, when you have this giant ball of flame on a ship that's almost the size of three football fields, it kind of tends to stick in your mind, right?
Right. And of course, you know, the Hindenburg was by no stretch the only major sort of big, you know, air travel disaster, but this one happened to have been caught on film and happened to have been captured on one of the most compelling bits of news audio, I think, that I can think of.
Yeah, definitely. So let's start a little bit with the background here. The German Luftschiff Zeppelin 129 Hindenburg remains the largest craft man has ever put in the air. And at the outset, let me say, we're going to do our best with these German names, but if you're listening to this in Germany, please feel free to correct our pronunciation.
Yeah. Das tut mir leid. Ich hatte Deutsch in der Schule gelernt, nur zwei Jahre. So I had 2 years of high school German, which I'll be leaning on heavily. So
I never knew that.
You never knew that?
No, I don't think you ever told me that you studied German. Wow, I know my mother did when she was there during the Blitz, as we mentioned before.
Right.
They had them learn German, I guess, just to be prepared.
Oh, gosh. So,
and the Norwegians, my friend Geir in Norway, big World War II fan also, so to speak. The Norwegian language is very similar to German, but after the war and the occupation and everything, they switched to learning English as their second language. And Norway is a great place that you can go and visit and speak English pretty much with anybody there of a certain age. So that's a good tip.
That's like that Steve Martin bit. Just a heads up, when you go to France, they don't even have the courtesy to speak English. What was that? I know a little bit of French. Chapeau means hat, bouffe means egg, and they brought me a shoe with cheese on it. So anyway.
Is Antoine still in Flatbush?
He is.
That's a good restaurant. Launched in March 1936, just over 245 meters long, as we mentioned before. The USS Enterprise 1701, the original Enterprise of so much fame in the original series, it's not that much longer at 289 meters. That gives you an idea. Of course, it wasn't armed with any phasers or photon torpedoes or anything. This dirigible was actually more like the Avengers helicarrier. It was a huge ship.
Yeah, that's actually a very good way to put it. This was a huge, huge balloon. It was named after a huge figure in Germany, Field Marshal Paul von Hindenburg, who was president of Germany for 9 years until he died about 2 years before the ship's launch, turning the leadership of the Reich over to everyone's least favorite asparagus sucker and giant global D-bag Chancellor Adolf Hitler.
In fact, his propaganda minister wanted to name the giant ship, Joseph Goebbels, of course, that would be, after the Fuhrer. And something we've talked about before, Owen and I, is how many Germans stood up to the Nazis. And
right.
we want to delve into that a little bit in the future. But this gentleman was one of them, Dr. Hugo Eckner, who was the head of the Zeppelin company. And he said, no, I'm not going to name my ship after Hitler. Forget it. I don't like you guys. I don't like your uniforms. I don't trust anyone who marches in step that much and is always screaming about other people being horrible. And so, no. And I think it's an interesting thought as far as when we get into some of the conspiracies at the time, and not really conspiracy theories, but suspect of, did somebody blow it up? Was it sabotage? Is, if this had been named Adolf Hitler after all, what would people think? I think it would have lived on much more. I think that it would be accepted fact today. Somebody must have blown it up because of it having the name Hitler on it.
Right.
So.
I always thought as a kid it was strange enough to see the swastika on the tail fin. You know, it was always such a striking visual for me as a child, not having a full grasp of what the hell was going on. But is this so weird? It's like, wait a second, swastika? And, you know, in America? What's going on here? Little did I know.
Yeah, flying over New York. I mean, it was really straight. It's eerie to look at those now. But, you know, at the time, it was, hey, just another country coming to visit and hang out and land there. And we were at peace with them. So that's an important thing to remember in 1937. We're at peace. This is a modern marvel. It's fast. It goes 84 miles an hour, which, you know, may sound slow to us, but it has these Benz 16-cylinder diesel engines. It can cross the Atlantic twice as fast as a boat does.
Yep.
It's fast. It's style. It's comfort. It would have never competed with planes.
Airships combine the pampering of a cruise ship with the speed of
some other slightly faster ship. Hello? Airplanes? Yeah, it's blimps. You win. Bye.
You know, it's funny, you talk about, you know, seeing that craft over New York and over Manhattan and in the harbor. That was not the ship that they wanted to send a few years later, Nazi Germany. That's a show for another time. The America bomber. But anyway, difference a few years makes. So who was on board? The Zeppelin started with 50 sleeping berths, and they later jacked that up to 72. There's a crew of 40 and an additional dozen stewards and cooks, and to keep passengers comfortable. There's even a writing room to get some work done, or you could hang out in that lounge if you didn't mind looking at the portrait of Herr Hitler.
Yeah, that must have been pretty strange to just have, you know, like now another thing that we look back on. I mean, it's just the head of state's portrait. But at the time, you'd be sitting there with him, you know, staring down at you. And it was kind of a strange feeling now to look at it and think, you know, hey, it's just to see Hitler in kind of everyday situations as far as how he was depicted. You know, this was pride of the German fleet. This was really a routine flight. They'd flown to Brazil before, and so this was just supposed to be a fun thing. And now the whole idea of traveling by balloon is, we heard there in that little bite from Archer that we threw in, it seems crazy because everything fast, fast, fast. But at the time, this was really a miracle of flight.
Oh, absolutely. And you often hear talk about going back to this dirigible idea. I mean, there are some amazing and beautiful designs for modern blimps, which are essentially the same thing, but it's just so well tweaked. Was it in World War Z that they had, not the movie, but the book, didn't they have like a floating command center, which was set in a blimp? There was something cool about that.
Yeah, I think so. Just to keep, because you could keep it up there probably without refueling it, right?
Yep.
You only really need because I can't imagine going up in one of those things and then staying up. And a lot of the crew transferred to the Graf Zeppelin, which was their other Zeppelin, the one that preceded the Hindenburg.
Right.
I can't imagine it. Like, I can't imagine going back and wanting to fly again in a Zeppelin. I'd say keep me away from Zeppelins after that.
Well, I guess there's so much is with that sort of thing is tied up in this notion of its own oversimplification, but just getting back on the horse. You know, you hear about flight attendants who are in crashes. They want to get back up in the air, that kind of stuff. You know, just to sort of purge the devil, as it were.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Makes sense, I guess.
Yep.
It's a certain kind of person, I guess. For me, I have a little bit of turbulence in the air. I don't want to fly anymore. I'm not going to get on a plane. I won't go.
And I've been flying a lot lately, and more than usual. And it's just, you know, every time I go up, and especially, you know, flying alone without the family. Of course, the conventional wisdom is, yes, I'd much rather my family die with me, you know, than by myself. But it is, I still can't help it. You know, if something weird happens, a little bit of turbulence, and, you know, if I'm not all liquored up, I'll tend to get a little freaked out. You know,
yeah,
it's like, this is a flying metal death tube that really has no business being in the air. But Zeppelins, gosh, I mean, except for being filled with hydrogen, what a pleasure it would have been to go hang out in one of them.
Yeah, and think about that, too. Like, we complain about planes. Okay, there's fuel, but there's fail safes and such.
Right.
This is a giant balloon filled with extremely flammable gas And, oh, by the way, they have a smoking room.
Yes.
Well, wouldn't you just think, hey, you know, have your last pipe in Berlin or wherever we're taking off from, and, you know, just maybe not until we get to the ground. I don't know.
I know. As an ex-smoker, I can justify just about anything as a smoker. And lighting up in a hydrogen, death trap. I'm sure that would not have been the first time.
Yeah, that was actually one of the bartender's jobs. Bartender Max Schulze, S-C-H-U-L-Z-E. Again, my German I don't have Owen's German background, which now makes me a little bit jealous. But it was his job to watch to make sure nobody took their pipe or their cigar or their cigarette out of the smoking room. Really? You just could have put it on the bartender, huh? Because I've seen some bartenders get pretty busy. I mean, he turns around for some schnapps, and the next thing you know, Herr Schickelgruber's out there with his pipe tripping. And especially since it's the bar. The people are probably drunk, and they're walking around smoking.
Exactly. It's like, you know what? I'm gonna go to the bathroom outside, and I'm going to bring a cigarette with me. I'm just going to go off the side. And, next thing you know, okay, we're in flames over the Atlantic.
And it's actually an interesting question that I never thought to ask till we started researching this, and that's, why hydrogen? Why not helium, which is obviously completely safe, does not ignite? And the reason was, with an eye again towards the war, the U.S. had a monopoly at the time on helium, and we didn't want to export it to any. We were afraid that they might use it for military uses, as you were just kind of alluding to, something like the America bomber. So we wouldn't allow them to have it, so they had to use hydrogen. And after this explosion, they kind of pushed through a law to allow for non-military use so that the next Zeppelins would have been able to have helium. But then Hitler went and annexed Austria, and so the U.S. government, Harold Ickes, decided he would quash that idea. And so before long, the world had more important things to worry about, and they would have jet airplanes by the time the war was over. So
isn't annexed such a nice clinical cold word, too?
Yeah.
Oh, they annexed Austria. Yes. Well, I mean, they did, but...
Well, when I was reading, they talked about how they flew the Zeppelin over all these lands, and one of them, like, oh, they flew over the Rhineland. They decided they would fly over. You know, they had speakers broadcasting propaganda. I mean, they wanted to make sure this was a symbol of Hitler and of his power.
Well, this thing, though, as it was, before it got to Lakehurst, this is basically a terrifying accident waiting to happen. In many ways, it's the worst Zeppelin since Coda. But she carried hundreds of passengers safely for 2 years. But the fire finally came in truly spectacular fashion. May 6th, 1937, while docking at Lakehurst, New Jersey, the great ship caught fire. And to this day, nobody is exactly sure why.
Yeah, they've done some tests, but nobody is exactly positive. We can never be sure. And they actually said that at the time. They said, everything's burned, so they couldn't really.
Right.
But they looked into it. I guess you'd have found if there was some sort of device. And this cabin boy that we mentioned, by the way, and we'll talk about it a little more later, he still believes it's sabotage. He's the last member of the crew that's still alive. Hmm. But he's not really concerned with it. I guess he's seen a lot since,
That's 37? Yeah. Gosh, yeah.
So, but it's just one of those things sticks in your mind.
Yep.
Of course, we've all heard the famous Herb Morrison recording. It's an eyewitness radio report. It was not live at the time for Chicago's WLS, which is an important distinction, nor was it married to the video. When we see it now, we usually see it put as an audio track to the plane crashing, and because the dirigible crashing. And so because in our minds, we're so used to a live report and we expect it, the fact that this was recorded was just really happenstance. He was testing some radio equipment with his engineer, Charlie Nelson, when the news broke, and it just happened right in front of him. And according to WLS radio, when he and his engineer were sort of going by, they're rushing, right? They fly back to Chicago to get them the recordings. They had these huge acetate discs. Again, this is not shot with your iPhone. These things are huge, as we talked about with Babe Ruth hauling this stuff all around. And it's new technology. They're out there testing it. And
the 130-pound portables that Alan Lomax and those guys used to collect all the Pearl Harbor stuff. Yep.
Yeah.
Nuts. Yeah. Portable.
Yeah, portable. And they found themselves being followed by the German SS officers. They'd say, this is, again, WLS says, because they wanted to kind of cover up the blow to German pride. I don't know if that's true, but I suppose it's possible. They did want to very tightly manage their image. And they, even though it sounds like it would have been pointless, everybody knew it caught fire. The SS were not going to just say, oh, hey, this happened on your watch. It's too bad. Or maybe you'll get fired. The system would have come down pretty heavy on them if they thought they didn't do everything possible to try to safeguard the image that Hitler was so carefully cultivating over there in Germany.
Their leaders told them that they were supermen. Herrenfolk, the Nazis called it.
the master race, destined to rule all other peoples on Earth. Take a good look at these humorless men. These were to be the rulers of the ruling race. Obey us blindly, and you will attain your rightful place in the world. All other people will be your slaves.
There are a bunch of myths related to the Hindenburg, and the fact that Morrison recorded his report debunks the claim that he was fired for losing it on the air. That's one of the things you heard. Oh, yeah, no, this guy, he just totally lost it, and then they got rid of him. I mean, listen, it is an extremely intimate, bare bit of recording. That's you know, it's upsetting if you stop and listen to it. And we were so used to hearing it, but if you stop and listen to what this poor man is witnessing, gosh, what a testament to keeping it together at all. Or even having, I don't know, the grace to allow himself to be human. I mean, this was a terrible human tragedy. If the station hadn't wanted to air it, they would have simply just not run the tapes. Here's Herb Morrison's report before the iconic Oh, the Humanity. Give a listen.
Now, we've been told that the airship is going to make an attempted landing in the rain. And if that is the case, we're going to have a mind-to-find description of you because the men will have a difficulty in keeping footing in the sand, and especially since it's wet. Now, the structure is light and yet so strong in the Hindenburg. From the ground, as the ship passes, we could see the passenger quarters. They're located just about a third of the distance back of the nose and just about a third of the distance from the keel. They're sort of square in shape and seem to extend the entire width of the ship. There are two decks, A and B, A being the main one and the one where most of the passengers assemble during the passage. Lining the sides of the deck are the observation windows. Now, that's planted so that it will give anyone in the interior a fine view downward. And no doubt, as the ship went over a number of times, the people were looking down at the great mass of humanity assembled here in the field. A thousand people have come out to witness the landing of this great airship. Now, there's a long, wide counter inside the observation section of the ship, and you can look down to the ground below, leaning on a table. And below the table, you see a relief map of the various air routes of the world. So as you travel along in the Hindenburg, you can watch the progress shown up on this map. Deck A is the upper of the two decks, and to get to deck B, it's necessary for you to walk through a foyer and down a pair of stairs. There you find what is really a combined smoking room and lounge. Passengers are always thrilled when Captain Max Priss or Captain Ernst Lehmann will take you a trip to the giant airship. So it's many sections, up and down along the aluminum alloy girders, over the catwalks which lead from one area to another, and then you see a maze of bright metal girders everywhere. And after a walk through the ship, you're ready to rest, where you've covered a great amount of space, and you realize that you have traveled a great distance. Now they're coming in to make a landing of the Zeppelin. I'm going to step out here and cover it from the outside, so as I move out, we'll just stand by a second. Well, here it comes, ladies and gentlemen. We're out now outside of the hangar, and what a great sight it is. A thrilling one. It's a marvelous sight. It's coming down out of the sky, pointed directly towards us and toward the mooring mast. The mighty diesel motors just roared, the propellers biting into the air and throwing it back into a gale-like whirlpool. No wonder this great floating palace can travel through the air at such a speed with these powerful motors behind it. The sun is striking the windows of the observation deck on the eastward side, and sparkling like glittering jewels on a background of black velvet. And every now and then, the propellers are caught in the rays of the sun, and their highly polished surfaces reflect circles of gold. Now, a field that we thought active when we first arrived is turned into a moving mass of cooperative action. The landing crews are rushed to their posts and spots in order to being passed along, and last-minute preparations are being completed for the moment we have waited for so long. The ship is riding majestically toward us like some great feather, riding as though it was mighty proud of a place it's playing in the world's aviation. The ship is no doubt bustling with activity, as we can see. Orders are shouted to the crew. The passengers are probably lining the windows, looking down the field ahead of them, getting their glimpse of the mooring mast. And these giant flagships standing here, the American Airlines flagships, waiting direction to all points in the United States when they get the ship moored. There are a number of important persons on board, and no doubt the new commander, Captain Max Priss, is thrilled, too, for this is his great moment, the first time he's commanded the Hindenburg. For in previous flights, he acted as the chief officer under Captain Lehmann. It's practically standing still now. They've dropped ropes out of the nose of the ship, and it's been taken a hold of down on the field by a number of men. It's starting to rain again. The rain had splashed up a little bit.
We should note that Morrison recorded his report at a slower speed. Again, they were testing the equipment. So when you play it back, it raises his pitch. He actually had a deeper voice. And it results in that faster, very clipped delivery. If you listen to it at what we think the normal speed was, the intended speed, he's still obviously seeing this horrible thing happening.
Right.
It doesn't sound quite so frantic. Although, even if you were reporting there for the Vulcan News Channel, I think you'd show some emotion when you see this horrendous fire. And he's seeing people, you know, burned literally alive before his eyes.
Yeah, it's a terrible thing. Here's more from Herb Morrison during the disaster.
The back motors of the ship are just holding it just enough to keep it from... It burst into flame. It burst into flame and it's falling. It's crazy. Get out of the way, get it started, it's crazy, terrible, oh my, get out of the way, please, it's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring fast, and all the folks between it, this is terrible, this is one of the worst catastrophes in the world, oh, it's place is 400 or 500 feet into the sky, and it's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen, the smoke and the flames now, and the frame is crashing to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast, all the humanity and all the furniture screaming around it. I don't do it. I can't even talk to people as things are on there. I can't talk, ladies and gentlemen. Honestly, it's just like a massive smoking wreckage. And everybody can't hardly breathe and talk and scream. Lady, I'm sorry. Honestly, I can hardly breathe. I'm going to step inside while I cannot see it. Tony, that's terrible. Listen, folks, I'm going to have to stop for a minute because I've lost my voice. This is the worst thing I've ever witnessed. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm back again. I've sort of recovered from the terrific explosion and the terrific crash that occurred just as it was being pulled down to the mooring mast. It's still smoking and flaming and crackling and banging down there. And I don't know how many of the ground crew were under it when it fell. There's not a possible chance for anyone to be saved. The relatives of the people who are waiting here, ready to welcome their loved ones that came off this great ship, are broken up. They're carrying them in to give them first aid and to restore them. Some of them have fainted. And the people are rushing down to the burning ship. The fire trucks have all gone down to see if they can extinguish any of the blaze whatsoever. But the terrible amount of hydrogen gas in it just caused the tail surface broke into flame first. Then there was a terrific explosion, and that followed by the burning of the nose and the crashing nose into the ground. And everybody carrying back at breakneck speed to get out from underneath it, because it was over the people at the time it burst into flames. Now, whether it fell on the people who were witnessing it, we do not know. But as it exploded, they rushed back. And now it's smoking, a terrific black smoke floating up into the sky. The flames are still leaping maybe 30, 40 feet from the ground, the entire 811 feet length of it. They're frantically calling for ambulances and things. The wires are being humming with activity. And I've lost my breath several times during this exciting moment here. Will you pardon me just a moment? I'm not going to stop talking. I'm just going to swallow several times until I can keep on. I should imagine that the nose is not more than 500 feet or maybe 700 feet from the mooring mast. They have dropped two ropes, and whether or not some spark or something set it on fire, we don't know, or whether something pulled loose on the inside of the ship causing a spark and causing it to explode in the tail surface. But everything crashed to the ground, and there's not a possible chance of anybody being saved. I wish I could stop in just a moment and see if I can get my breath again.
Those bites are how history hears Herb Morrison, so that's how he played them. But here's a clip of that same report that we slowed down to normal speed, as he recorded it that day while running his tests. The delivery and effect on the listener are quite different.
The back motors of the ship are just holding it just enough to keep it from bursting the flames.
Get it started. It's crashing. Terrible. Oh, my. Get out of the way, please. It's running and bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring fast, and all the folks would believe that this is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, it's 400 or 500 feet into the sky. It's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and the flames now, and the frame is crashing to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast. All the humanity and all the furniture screaming around it. I can't talk, ladies and gentlemen.
Morrison died in 1989, a few years before his death. He shared some of his memories with the Associated Press. He said, quote, "We saw things falling out of the Hindenburg. We'd only a few seconds to have it dawn and knew that it was a tragedy. Some of the things falling out were people," end quote. And for anyone who was, you know, had their TV set on September 11, 2001, or lived down in the neighborhood like me, that was a big part of the day. And that's when you do begin to realize that this is something that's maybe beyond what anyone has seen before. And certainly disaster did happen. But when you see a human external of a building like the World Trade or external of a vessel like Hindenburg, it truly drives it home in a way that you can't put too fine a point on.
But as we mentioned earlier, Morrison fortunately was wrong about nobody surviving. And
yeah,
we mentioned a few times about it catching fire, about it collapsing, this kind of thing. It didn't explode. Had it exploded, it would have taken a lot more people. It would have killed everybody on the ground. It would have really caused a lot of more death and destruction. So it really just burned. It didn't explode. It slowly collapsed on itself. And so that's one reason why people were able to run on the ground crew. It's a reason why people like the cabin boy were able to escape. This doesn't mean that when you jumped out of it, though, everyone was unscathed, of course. One of the people Herb Morrison saw running out, quote, "His clothes had been all burned off, and he just had his shorts on." And like a good reporter, he's on the scene. He tried to talk to some of these people, but there was a language barrier. He didn't have 2 years of even high school German to fall back on. The cabin boy that falls out, he also tried to run back and help people because one of the other crewmen said, "What are you doing standing here? Let's try to help someone." And one of the U.S. Navy guys grabbed him and said, "No, what are you doing?" You know, he was trying to help him, and he said for a minute he forgot the English words for it, and so he just kept saying in German, "I'm the cabin boy on the Hindenburg," and then they realized, and only 14 he was, by the way, so
right, it's amazing.
What a thing to live through.
Yeah, I remember as a kid watching it, and you're watching a couple of those guys who are holding on to the mooring lines, and it's like you're thinking, please let go, please let go, please let go. Now it's like, oh, it's just too late. If you let go, you're doomed anyway. Terrible.
Yeah,
terrible.
And they believe that that's what grounded the ship and caused the spark. I mean, as we said, it's impossible to know exactly what, but we'll get into that a little bit later, that was the moment that, because of the storm and the atmospherics and the thunderstorm and the water that was on the skin of the ship, that's what caused the spark that ignited the fire. But we can never really know.
Yeah, I think it's only about a year before the Martians landed in New Jersey.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Carl Phillips again, out at the Wilmoth Farm, Grover's Mill, New Jersey. That's the thing directly in front of me.
Metal casing is definitely extraterrestrial. Not found on this Earth. Cylindrical
shape. Just a minute. Something's happening. Ladies and gentlemen, this is terrific. This end of the thing is beginning to flake off. The top is beginning to rotate like a screw, and this thing must be hollow.
So maybe it was like a scout ship, I think, that hit it. That's what I heard. That's what I heard.
Yeah, you heard that. If you believe the official story.
Yeah, sure. If you believe the official story. I read that. Right?
Document your source.
Document your source. Yeah, exactly. Citation, please. This is why we're doomed. All right, anyway. What was the experience like inside the great ship? Werner Franz, the ship's 14-year-old cabin boy, who we've been talking about, he was clearing plates in the officers' quarters when the disaster hit. And so he was still alive for the 75th commemoration 2 years ago. Notice we say commemoration, not anniversary. We don't anniversary bad things.
Yep.
And he told Stars and Stripes at the 50-year mark in 87, quote, "All the china came flying out of the cabinets. It happened so fast. It was like a movie passing by. You act instinctively," which is generally what happens in a disaster. You all of a sudden get that adrenaline rush to the heart, which is, you know, your body and nature trying to do everything it can to help give you an edge to stay alive.
Yeah, he would have been in the bow of the ship, and he wanted to be there with the other crew because it gave a much better view of New York City. But like a good young man, loyal to his ship, he knew he still had dishes to wash, and so he was just stuck in the kitchen, kind of looking out that lousy window. Luckily for him, because everybody in the nose died, and he would have died too had he been there. But he's just there. There's a fire. He goes out the door. He sees the fireball coming towards him, you know, like End of Lethal Weapon style. And he runs back. They talk about him backpedaling, and I hear it as, you know, like the Flintstones' feet.
Right.
And he grabbed a girder. He's dangling in the air as the ship's collapsing around him. All the plates are flying.
Goodness.
And he says he sees his life flash before his eyes. So not just a metaphor. He only had 14
years. He said, "I'm going to die in New Jersey?"
Yeah.
Sorry.
I probably will, so thanks.
No, that's
I don't want to die anywhere, but I'd rather die in New Jersey.
No, absolutely.
Probably be like that little. I'll probably drown right between Staten Island. That'd be even worse. I'll probably wash up
in the Arthur Kill. Yeah.
Why do you have me thinking of this?
I'm sorry. Okay. This is what we do. This is where our minds go when we're left unattended.
Well, I was born here, so if I die here, I like a certain amount of symmetry.
No, me too. Me too. This is why I'm. I got my fingers crossed for Brooklyn. So.
Yeah, sure.
I'm gonna take you out in the back and put you down. So. and to be clear to all our listeners, especially the ones right across the Hudson, I love New Jersey. I've never had a problem with New Jersey. You do the old pile. I'm from Brooklyn. You know, it's sort of, you know, you have to at least do some of that. But my wife is from New Jersey. My pal Dean is from New Jersey. It's a hell of a place.
That's nice. You know, I have the same thing with my wife being from Canada. That chip, your chip just kicked in a little late. My chip would kick in right in the middle of saying something bad about Canada. Not that I have anything bad to say about Canada.
No. What could you possibly say?
Yeah. And my wife is now an American citizen, though. So
that's right.
I tease her and I say, now, you have to forget 75% of your hockey knowledge and everything, everything you knew about Canada. I said to her, what's the capital of Canada? And she said, no, Americans think it's Toronto. You got to forget all that stuff now. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And all the other stuff, like they actually have their own currency, which I didn't know until about a week ago. I thought they just used our money because it was easy.
But yeah, they have loonies and toonies.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
If you don't know why, look it up.
That's right. Canada, you're awesome. So. Anyway, enough about you, Canada.
Canada dry. Were
you Canada?
Patriot love. You don't know the words.
Nope, not
typical
at all.
Typical American.
Fan. Living in my tiny little box, you know, fearing the Germans on one coast and the Japanese on the other.
Don't make me do it in French, because I will do it in French.
Anyway. Back in Germany, Franz's parents saw their son's name on the death list. Where it stayed for an hour until it was updated. Of course, if this was today, you know, it would have been tweeted and it would have been, you know.
Oh, yeah.
But Franz returned to Germany in a couple of days, but not before catching a movie at Radio City Music Hall with surviving crewmates. He told Stars and Stripes he prefers to remember the adventure of the Hindenburg's trips to South America rather than the disaster.
Yeah, he really, as a young man, he was looking forward to coming to New York City and seeing it. And when the weather forced the Hindenburg to kind of float around the New Jersey coast, go up to Sandy Hook, go down to Forked River, which again, we talked about with Babe Ruth, and just sort of wait for the weather to clear. Fortunately, we now know that was kind of like rubbing a balloon on your shirt, I guess, where it was picking up that static electricity proved fatal. As the flames consumed the ship, he jumped through one of the thick cloth covers over a hatch. Cook saw him, followed him out, and he showed the way. And they ran away from the burning ship, screaming panic all around them. He describes this very vividly. He says, again, had he been in that landing detail, which would have been his usual post, had he washed those dishes faster, he'd have died with the rest of the crew and the captain. All of them in the nose of the ship, all of them perished. So.
And you can't help but do these if-ifs in your head, you know? Gosh. Yeah.
And one amazing thing that I read, too, of his account of it was his grandfather had given him a watch. And after he gets a big bucket of water falls on him, basically, when he's in there, and that helped him not to catch fire. And he says it reminded him of when they hazed him into the crew when he crossed the equator. They dumped water on him, and that was when he kind of really became a member of the crew. He says they never treated him like he was a young kid. They hazed him. They respected him. And so they get him dry clothes and such. And afterwards, he says, can I go back and look? Because my grandfather gave me a watch. And believe it or not, he finds it where his cabin was there. It hadn't been destroyed in the fire. That's amazing to me.
That really is. Gosh, and well, hopefully it put a bow on it for him. He was able to, you know, grab something out of it that was useful, you know, the whole terrible experience.
And again, he wanted to go back and serve again. He testified to the Commerce Department, the committee and Congress on it. And the lieutenant colonel comes from the German Air Ministry also to kind of lend a hand, a little bit of a joint investigation here. Mm-hmm. And Werner Franz says to him, Herr Oberstlieutenant, when the next Zeppelin is ready, may I fly again with her?
It's great.
I mean, his kid's only 14 years old, and he's still fearless, you know, of having survived that. It's amazing.
No, get back on the horse, you know?
Yeah, they all did. A lot of them, you know, they just got transferred to the Graf Zeppelin, and they kept flying.
Yep, it's crazy.
As we said, more people survived than died. Of the 97 souls on board, about 35 died. Morrison described the ground crew running for cover. All but one unlucky guy escaped. Here's the rest of the Universal newsreel we rolled at the top of the show, days after the disaster. It's important to note that the ship burned. Had it exploded, the death toll would have been much worse, so that's a positive to take away from it. Here's that Universal newsreel from 1937.
Passengers and crew, the fortunate among them, fell or jumped and were dragged to safety before the fiery furnace took their lives. Heroic work by Navy and Army men risking their lives around the white-hot skeleton snatched more than one dazed and half-burned passenger from the blazing wreckage. But for the most of those trapped in the incandescent tangle, there was no hope. It's the greatest of miracles that anyone came out of the disaster alive. Seven million cubic feet of inflammable hydrogen gas blazed up in less than a minute. The hundreds of tons of fuel oil burns for an hour or more with its dense black smoke making a pall over the tragic scene. In all the history of air disasters, this is the worst, the most terrible. Hailed as the luxury liner of the air, the Hindenburg's horrible end has shocked the entire world. The pride of the skies reaches its journey's end.
Just last year, British aeronautical engineer Jem Stansfield reenacted the disaster on scale models of the blimp with historian Dan Grossman. This is so cool. Stansfield said, quote, "We blew them up in ways that corresponded to theories about the Hindenburg disaster. We looked for explosions that looked most like the way the Hindenburg went down. As airships burn, their buoyancy changes, so it's quite distinctive," unquote.
Yeah, they found that the airship had a new waterproof coating that rainy day.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the coating, though, had a side effect that they couldn't have known in these early days of flying. The coating meant water pooled over its skin, and that's the water that picked up electricity as the weather was changing and they were rushing to land. So they think that when the men on the ground grabbed those landing ropes, they grounded the great ship, and that charge sparked within the ship's skeleton, and the next thing, everything was on fire.
Here's another newsreel clip, this one on the search for answers in the aftermath of the crash. Give a listen.
A twisted, tangled mass of seared girders and bits of blackened fabric are all that remains of the proud luxury airliner Hindenburg that lies at the Lakehurst Naval Station. The death list is now 35, with 10, including Captain Preuss, still on the critical list. With the next morning's first light, a naval inspection board headed by Captain Haynes inspects the wreckage, as others search the still smoking ruins for a possible clue that might yield a key to the mysterious disaster. The remains of the Hindenburg will not be moved until the arrival of Germany's expert, Dr. Hugo Eckener, who heads a commission that will conduct an investigation simultaneously with the Department of Commerce. German Ambassador Hans Luther was the first Reich observer to arrive, visiting the injured at the hospital in nearby Lakewood, but refusing to comment on anything connected with the disaster. As soon as is possible, the injured who can be moved are carried to ambulances for transfer to New York, 60 miles away, so as to receive everything that medical science can offer. Swathed in bandages, they may be more than thankful for their miraculous escape from the blazing inferno of the Hindenburg. Members of the crew not seriously injured were housed in the officers' mess at the naval station. 13-year-old Werner Franz, a cabin boy, is the youngest survivor who will appear before the Department of Commerce Investigation Board that calls Commander Rosendahl, head of the naval station, as first witness. But experts believe the exact cause of the greatest of air disasters will never be known. Over the Hindenburg will loom a question mark that can never be forgotten.
It's those conspiracy theories about sabotage that Stansfield and Grossman were trying to debunk. This was a Nazi ship, after all. And those photographs of the swastikas flying over the skyline, you know, as we were saying, it's really kind of weird to our modern eyes, you know, knowing what was going to come in the next decade for Germany. And it's something to consider, the sadness with which everyone greeted the crash, and contrast that with the fact that Germans and Americans would be trying to shoot each other out of the sky in just 4 years' time.
Hindenburg's fiery crash, combined with Morrison's description, ended the public's love affair with these airships, as I guess you'd imagine. You know, there's always a dip when we have a plane crash today,
mm-hmm.
even though those are incredibly safe. It doesn't really help to tell yourself that when you see one on the air. And now we really do see everything live. So that ended it, which is amazing considering that the solution would have been just to say, no, it's helium now and it doesn't catch fire. But it was so vivid to people that they just didn't want to have any part of it. This is plastered on every newspaper cover. You can check a lot of that. We're going to have it at angryhistory.com, as always,
yep.
Links to talk about it. They had planned at the time bigger, more expensive dirigibles, but they stayed on the drawing board, and they were never built.
The Lakehurst Historical Society Museum has charred remnants of the Hindenburg, a 12-foot-long model made from fudgesicle sticks, amazingly, dinnerware and other artifacts, and they also erected a memorial to those who lost their lives.
Well, thank you very much for joining us again here to talk about the Hindenburg. We hope the next time you hear the Oh, the Humanity, you have a few things to remember there about it.
Yeah.
And about Herb Morrison. And, you know, when you think about countries around the world, you think about things like this, disasters, they really do bring us together as countries. And it's nice to see that even after this giant disaster of World War II, that people still remember this here in Lakehurst, New Jersey. And there's many stories like this that we want to continue to bring to you. As I said, after a little bit of a hiatus while we did a bunch of other history projects that we're not trying to tease you, but you will hear a lot about, we're going to ramp up production now. We're going to try to hit you every 2 weeks so you can get on a regular schedule with us. Keep tweeting us at Angry History. Keep following our Facebook page. Keep telling people about us because we're back now and we're going to keep hitting you with stuff.
Yep. And don't forget to check us out on our Grindr account.
Oh, yeah. And we should have MySpace. So MySpace is now history. MySpace is history.
I know. See? Exactly.
Yeah, your son will read about that in school. There was this thing called MySpace.
That's right, as he neglects me in a far-flung room of my home someplace. But no, I don't know where that webcam came from.
He'll have a webcam. He'll be able to look up. You'll be on Channel 4 or something.
Exactly, right. I'll be calling him on my bone phone, the little bone conduction phone in my jaw, and he just won't come in. But anyway, enough about my nightmares.
well, right, guys, speaking of where you're born, he was born out in California, which I knew is not what you wanted. So
it's funny, you know, once it happens, having a kid born in a certain place tends to soften you on that, whatever that place is. So a lot of my vitriol was just sort of ripped out from under me when he was born. So what can you do? That's why I put my hatred onto Canada, where it belongs.
Tisk.
We love you, Canada. So
and
we'll start
New Jersey. I mean, what? You should be filled with more love.
You know what it is?
Talked about the Germans and the Nazis. Can't you at least just hate Hitler?
I guess. Actually, you know what I can do? Just between you and me? Hell Hydra!
Oh, God. Speaking of which, we are going to do a show on both the new X-Men and Godzilla. We will do an extra.
Yes.
Because you guys really seem to enjoy the Star Trek World War Z1. And it's a bunch of people have asked us there at Angry History on Twitter when we're going to do another one. So
we're going to definitely do that. And it's funny, you know, we were whining about during the JFK show how they sort of tied Magneto to this poorly timed released, you know, teaser for the movie. But now actually having seen the movie, like we said then too, you know, we were going to go in there with the intention of enjoying it, and we did. It was a lot of fun, and they do a lot of very cool sort of historical callbacks in both films, actually, in Godzilla and in X-Men. So we'll have that to look forward to. Cool. And speaking of my son's hometown, we're going to do the Battle of Los Angeles, which was basically, it's a hell of a story about wartime jitters that hit this city to deadly effect in February of 42. So we got a lot going on. We're psyched to be back.
Yeah, we have a ton of stuff, and we're looking forward to it. And by the way, please stop saying Hell Hydra to me when you see me on the subway. I don't need people whispering that in my ear. Are you hiring those people? Because it's weirding me out.
Yeah, well, I guess that's a brotherhood. But it's on me.
I tell you that when I saw that in Captain America Winter Soldier, Gary Shandling, I was like, no! Gary Shandling's in the Hydra. I was suddenly a 5-year-old kid watching Monster Week or something. It just really freaked me out. So well done.
Well done. And Winter Soldier, by the way, awesome. Cap was in great hands.
Yep.
Really terrific movie. All right. Hey, listen, guys, it is so great to be back and so great to be coming in to you in your homes through the miracle of technology. I'm Owen Mugen.
I'm Dean Karyanis.
We'll see you next time. Take care.
Hail Hydra.
Hail Hydra.
I once loved a sailor. Once a sailor loved me. But he was not a sailor. Who sailed on the wide blue sea. He sailed in an airship, sailed like a bird on the wing. And every evening at midnight he would come to my window and sing. Come take a trip in my airship. Come sail. We'll travel to Venus. We'll sail away to Mars. No one will see while we're kissing. No one will know as we swoon. So come take a trip in my airship, and we'll visit the man in the moon.
Visit angryhistory.com to learn more about the topics discussed on today's episode. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You can also like us on Facebook, tweet us at Angry History, or send us an email to angry@angryhistory.com.
One night, while sailing away from the clouds, we passed through the Milky White Way. While idly drifting, watching the clouds, he asked if I'd name the day. Just by the dipper, I gave him my heart. The sun shone on a honeymoon. We swore to each other we'd never would part, and we teach all the babies this tune. Come take a trip in my